Welcome to the Atlantic Council Events Podcast. The Atlantic Council serves the global community by bringing together world leaders, foreign policy experts, and great thinkers to shape today's policy choices and navigate the global challenges of the 21st century. In the following program, Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Warner launched the Atlantic Council report, Empowering America, How Energy Abundance Can Strengthen U.S. Global Leadership, and discuss the ways in which we can pursue our responsibilities as a global leader on energy and the environment. The event took place on July 30th, 2015.
I'm Dick Morningstar. I'm the founding director of the Global Energy Center here. And I want to welcome, say good morning, and welcome all of you to the Atlantic Council. And we're happy to see such an excellent turnout for the launch of our new task force report, Empowering America, How Energy Abundance Can Strengthen U.S. Global Leadership, which we hope will make a major mark on the discourse on energy and national security policy in Washington and beyond. First and foremost, I want to thank Senators Murkowski and Warner for their extraordinary leadership as co-chairs of the task force. We truly could not have had a better pair of senators to lead this critical effort to assess the ways in which the United States' energy abundance can be leveraged to strengthen American leadership, advance international security, and promote global prosperity. We're particularly pleased that this task force was a bipartisan effort, that Senators Murkowski and Warner reached across the aisle on this project, and that's a testament to their leadership and their commitment to standing at the forefront on these issues. I'd like to take a moment to thank the many other contributors to our task force. I can't do it by individual name with everybody, but I particularly want to thank my co-director, David Goldwyn, who is chairman of the Energy Center Advisory Group, and it's his vision was the driving force behind this project from day one. The rapporteur, Bud Coote, who did a phenomenal job, and that was integral in producing the final report today. And unfortunately, because of unavoidable circumstances, he cannot be with us today. Our task force members, we just had a great task force, many of whom are here today, and our guest speakers, who generously lent their expertise to form the analytical foundation of this report. And I can say, and I think it's somewhat unusual, we had 18 members of the task force. Every one of them signed on to the report. That's not to say that every one of them agreed with every single sentence, but every one of them signed on to the report. The Senate staff, Tristan Abbey from Senator Murkowski's staff, and Kristen Sharp and Ken Johnson from Senator Warner's staff, who were absolutely instrumental in the drafting and the editing process of the report. And finally, our Atlantic Council team, as well as David's team at his firm, our deputy director, Annie Medaglia, as well as Chris Brown and Suzanne McDaniel, and David's colleagues, Lee Hendricks and Corey Gill, all of whom provided incredible insight and put in the groundwork to make this report a reality. Before introducing Senator Murkowski and Warner, I'd like to make a few very brief comments on the report and what I think, anyway, makes it unique. From the earliest stages of this process, we were determined to put forward a report that paints a holistic picture of the relationship between American energy abundance and global leadership. For this reason, we convened a task force not only of energy specialists, but also of foreign policy, defense, and economic experts. By tapping into this broad range of expertise, we were able to put forth a report that provides a detailed assessment of the value of American energy resources as a strategic asset in the U.S. foreign policy toolkit. I won't delve into a detailed description of the task force recommendations. In fact, there are many, many copies outside if you haven't picked them up. But I'll say this. It's crystal clear to us that if properly utilized, America's energy abundance, which extends from hydrocarbon resources to renewable energy to technical expertise and innovation, will be an invaluable tool that strengthens American leadership, advances international security, and promotes global prosperity. To this end, we call on U.S. policymakers to repeal the crude oil export ban and ease the licensing process for LNG exports, as well as to invest in R&D for alternative technologies of different kinds, including renewable energy. It's crucial also to make the point that the policies that we advocate for in this report are not incompatible with the U.S. responsibility to continue to lead in the global effort for climate change, to combat climate change, and to create a cleaner environment through sustainable energy solutions. Now, before I turn the floor over, I'd like to make just a very few introductory remarks about the task force co-chairs, who really need no introduction. Senator Murkowski chairs the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, which, as you all know, has been busy of late, introducing a comprehensive energy bill that is currently being marked up, and in fact, she may have to leave a few minutes early to get to the markup on the Hill. And she has long been one of the most prominent voices here in Washington on energy issues and has been an unrelenting advocate for a strong energy agenda for the United States. Senator Mark Warner, the former governor of Virginia, serves on the Senate Finance, Banking, Budget, and Intelligence Committees. He's worked tirelessly to support strong private sector innovation within the energy sector and a diversified portfolio approach, particularly focusing on new technologies like solar, wind, biofuels, nuclear, and next-generation battery technologies. So we could not be more pleased to be joined by Senators Murkowski and Warner this morning. After they speak, David Goldwin will moderate a Q&A session with the senators. And just as a final housekeeping note, I'd encourage you all in the audience and those following on the webcast online to get involved in today's conversation on Twitter using the hashtag #ACEnergy. And so without further ado, I'll turn the floor over to Senator Murkowski, who will be immediately followed by Senator Warner. Thank you.
Ambassador, thank you for the introduction. Thank you for the opportunity to serve as the co-chair with my friend and colleague, Senator Warner, on this very important issue, recognizing where we are today and how in Washington, D.C., timing is everything. I don't know that I could have programmed this any better. In just less than an hour now, I will be going back to resume the third day of the Energy Committee markup on an energy product that we've been working on, I would say for months, my staff would say for years, but it is a product that in fact takes so much of what you have incorporated through the very important work of this task force, the very important work of the men and women that have contributed so much analysis and thought and discussion and debate, and we are seeing that actually translated into legislation that will hopefully pass before noon on a pretty strong bipartisan basis. So we're working to make real so much of what you have been focused on. So again, timing is important around Washington, D.C., and the fact that we are here announcing and standing before you this very impressive report at the same time that we're moving out of the Senate Energy Committee, significant legislation is quite telling. As I say, I'm very pleased to have been able to serve with Senator Warner on this. I think we both bring different skill sets to the issue. I'm very immersed in what happens with this supply-demand end of energy production and how we can facilitate that across the country. But you can't make advances in our energy sector unless we have the know-how, the technologies, the advancements in an area that I think clearly Senator Warner brings to the table. And the focus that you all have provided through your task force and through this report to focus us more keenly on how energy and security are tied together. And truly, the nexus between security and energy has never been tighter or more clear than it is now. Topics of the day. We don't need to tick them off, but just name a few countries. You've got Iran, China, Russia, Syria, Yemen, Egypt, Libya, all the discussion about ISIS, the discussion on the floor all week, all last week about selling off the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the timeliness, again, of this report, and again, the nexus between security and energy as strong and as clear as ever. This report is an achievement. I think it represents what should be bipartisan consensus. And that consensus is that America should serve as a global leader on energy and the environment, and there should not be any contradiction between the two. And you've noted that, Ambassador. I do not think that we need to suggest at any point that this is an either-or proposition. You either have energy production or you have a safer, cleaner environment. That is not the way that we operate, nor should we operate in this country. They should be inextricably tied, and it should lead us to bipartisan consensus as opposed to division. So I've been working, again, through the Energy Committee, working with my colleague, Senator Cantwell from Washington as my ranking member, to build out a bipartisan energy bill. It's about 357 pages, maybe more, maybe less, given the amendments. We've processed about 100 amendments already, and that product will again move forward this morning, but we're also moving forward this morning a very significant measure, and that is a measure that we have entitled the Offshore Production and Energizing National Security Act. Good acronym is OPENS. OPENS. Makes sense. It fully repeals the outdated ban on oil exports. It still preserves the emergency of the authority of the president, just exactly as the report has suggested and outlined. It is an incorporation of several different revenue sharing measures that I have advanced along with Senator Cassidy from Louisiana, as well as Senator Warner from recognizing the input, the potential input from the Southern Atlantic. We talk a lot about energy, but we haven't done enough. We haven't done sufficient work when it comes to updating our energy policies. We haven't seen an energy bill out of the United States Senate, out of the Congress, since 2007. The landscape, the world has changed dramatically since then. But the vote that we will have this morning on authorizing oil exports, we haven't seen a discussion in a congressional committee that has actually moved to a vote on authorizing oil exports since, well, about 20 years now. In fact, I was told that the last time that the Energy Committee discussed this, it was when they were discussing lifting the ban on exports from Alaska for North Slope crude, when it was the other Senator Murkowski that was leading that debate. So history kind of comes full circle here. But recognizing where your report goes, the emphasis, the connect, and the assurance that when we're talking about this nexus between security and energy, that lifting this ban on the oil export is key to it. But the report goes so much further than that. The LNG exports, pipelines, regional perspectives, modernizing the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, improving the energy security of our closest allies. This is what we can do when we view energy as a strategic asset, as a tool, an effective tool and a mechanism to be a lever, a key lever in our foreign policy toolkit. It is something that we must look to, that we have the opportunity to look to, and your report guides us in that direction. Bureau of Energy Resources at the State Department is obviously very active in this area, as is the International Energy Office at DOE. European energy diversification, supporting new pipelines, allowing U.S. exports of oil and gas, this is the perfect example, truly the perfect example of the concepts and policies that we should be pushing. So look forward to the opportunity for a little Q&A afterwards. And again, if I have to excuse myself a couple minutes early, it's to finish the good work of good folks back on the Hill. But thank you for your efforts and your focus on an incredibly important aspect of our energy policy. And to my friend, Senator Warner, thank you for all that you've been doing working with us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Lisa, and thank you for those comments. Also, I've found in the 6.5 years I've been in the Senate, if there are a group of us from both parties, if we could put us in a room and lock the door for a while, we could get a whole lot of things solved. And Lisa Murkowski is definitely one of those people that should be in any of those rooms, not just about energy, fiscal policy, you name it. Let me also thank Dick Morningstar and Dave Goldwyn for your leadership on this report. And quite honestly, for the continuing breadth of work that's coming out of the Atlantic Council. This is one of the think tanks in Washington that has expanded its reach in the last few years on a subject of enormous importance to our country, both domestically and obviously from the international standpoint. I want to go through again a little bit of kind of repeat so we can get to the question and answers of what Lisa's already said. I mean, we're at this moment in time not necessarily because in the past we've taken the right federal policies, but because of the enormous innovation that's taken place in the American economy, particularly in the energy sector. Who could have imagined a decade ago, and I say this humbly, and Lisa will have forgotten more about energy than I'll ever know, but who would have thought a decade ago that we would have this kind of access to energy right here in North America, not only in terms of a tremendously expanding, traditional hydrocarbon base, but as we continue to look at ways to use and utilize coal in cleaner fashions, the tremendous growth in renewable energy, the slope as you look towards about 2006 and 7 of renewables is really a remarkable transition. Now, still means there's challenges. We've seen a lot of this growth, particularly on the oil side around fracking. There still needs to be making sure that we follow the science and safety to make sure that we can use that tool in a way that's appropriate. But with this increased access, we've got to recognize that our national energy policies have to stay up with that, both in terms of what that does for our economy, but more particularly as one of the parts of this report that I was so interested in focusing in on the national security components. Clearly, and what Lisa's going to go up and do on the Hill a little bit later today, is continuing steps in this direction in terms of federal policy makers. This report talks about policies like in continuing to expand exports. I think there's opportunities around that. I think there's going to be political challenges as well, something that I think we all will have to work through. It's one of the reasons why, but we're seeing the value of expanding exports. Let's take natural gas for a moment. I see friends here in the room who are in the LNG business. We've already seen by the process of granting some of the permits for LNG how that has started to affect the ability, particularly in Europe, of the notion that there will be opportunities to get access to American natural gas is starting to rebalance a little bit of the energy security needs in Europe, something that's terribly important as we think about how we wean European nations, friends and not so friends, particularly off of their addiction to Russian oil and gas. As well, we ought to look in terms of energy security policies about how we help our allies and developing nations. Now, part of what this report does as well is lay out how those nations and America in conjunction can manage their resource allocation, can increase their strategic stocks, how we can make sure that we create a base load that builds into that base load renewable energy, and how we can make sure that from a national standpoint, an international standpoint, we can manage for strategic disruptions. Even with the tremendous increase of American energy sources, we still have the overwhelming amount of hydrocarbons, at least, that still pass through the Straits of Hormuz, not a part of the world that is getting less dangerous. This report, again, echoes the settlement that energy security is not a national, is not a natural occurrence. And it's going to require our nation, from a national strategic standpoint, to engage with our allies, thinking about this abundance new resource we have, thinking about how we can bring it to bear as a diplomatic tool. And I want to emphasize what both Lisa and Dick said, and that is that the notion that of increasing America's energy output and at the same time not stepping back from our commitment to take on the very real threat of climate change are in no ways contradictory. I think we can both of those get done. I would point out to the fact, because of the tremendous upsurge in natural gas production, who would have thought 20 years ago that it would be actually America leading most of the industrial world in terms of hitting the Kyoto Accord numbers. I've mentioned what we need to do on what we've done on LNG. I'm anxious to continue the conversation about domestic oil exports. I think opportunities but challenges remain there as well. But I also would advise for all here this morning, take a look at the component parts on how this affects our national security. This was a terribly important part of the report, something that I wanted to learn from. I think we've got a series of recommendations on national security that are both immediate and long-term. It is going to require actions in Congress. It's going to require actions in the administration. And I know this is, I hesitate to say, Senator Murkowski and I were talking last night, but at a place that hasn't necessarily always been productive over the last few years, and that may not be a news flash, so there is this sense right now, maybe it's just because we're thinking about August recess, but there is this sense that there's a lot of us maybe of cooler heads that might be able to see actually how we get things done rather than simply blame each other for what doesn't get done. Energy is one of those areas under Senator Murkowski's leadership where I think we can put some points on the board. Thank you all very much.
Great. Well, thank you, Senators. And since time is short, let's jump right in. Senator Murkowski, if I can start with you, it sounds like you're about to make some progress in producing a bill out of committee. But can you take us through how you get from a bill out of committee to legislation that lands on the president's desk? How do you see things moving through the Senate? How do you see things moving with the House? And have you had any hint of a veto or an indication from the White House that if you delivered a bill that they wouldn't sign it?
Well, the path to this proposal some months ago to actually becoming law is working together and producing a product that is not a Republican product or a Democrat product or a product that only works in Alaska or that only works for the Northeast, but truly is in the national interest. And I think this is what Senator Cantwell and I have been attempting to build. Some will look at this and say, wait a minute, how can a senator from Alaska endorse an energy bill that doesn't have opening up ANWR, that isn't more heavy on increased domestic production from the oil side? And what we have is a compromise bill. It is a bill that has really come together through a lot of hard work, a lot of give and take. And the hope that we both have is that today we will be able to move a bill through that enjoys bipartisan support. So that's the first step. You have to be able to demonstrate that this works for both sides of the ledger. We then have to be able to demonstrate that there's sufficient support within the Senate that it's a priority. So I have to make sure that the majority leader understands the significance and the priority that we attach to advancing energy legislation for the first time in 8-9 years, and why it's important to us from the perspective of a legislative accomplishment. You dangle the threat of a presidential veto. I'm sure that if the administration looked long and hard enough through this bill that we have put together, that they could find one piece that they don't like. I can find lots of pieces that I don't like. But how productive is that? Don't stop us before we get started. Allow us to build, allow us to legislate, allow us to govern. And so there have been suggestions that, well, if this is in, then you know it's veto bait. I'm not buying that for a minute. What I'm going to work on, and I think what Senator Cantwell is willing to work on, and I think what like-minded members are willing to work on, is how do we modernize our energy policy? You do it through building good legislation. You do it through working across the aisle. You do it by bringing the administration in. The LNG export piece that we have on here is based on good communication back and forth within the department, working with Secretary Moniz, taking his ideas, and building it together. So we've got a path forward, and I'm optimistic.
That's great. Senator Warner, let me ask you the same question in a slightly different way. There's at least a narrative that the administration has sort of tried its base a bit with the trade bill, and it's made climate change a top priority. So if they're going to do something on crude oil exports, that there needs to be something in there on the environmental side also. Without putting you on the spot to speak for the White House, do you have a sense of the kinds of things that the administration might be looking for, or do you think there's enough in the bill already to give them a win on the issues that are important to them?
Well, I think there's a number of colleagues, myself included, who realize if we're going to really have a diversified energy portfolio, you've got to look at not only traditional fossil fuels, but there's enormous growth in renewables and other energy sources. I also think there's a moment in time here, and I would agree with Senator Murkowski on this, where the stars may be partially aligning. And what I'm hoping is that everybody will go into this debate with an open mind, and that there may be some new suggestions that may be revamped suggestions from old that ought to be part of this discussion. In any kind of legislative process, there's some trading and horse trading involved, and both sides having to be willing to compromise a little bit. On a personal comment, we're dealing in the Senate right now with a transportation bill that, frankly, I've not been supportive of because it has absolutely no nexus in terms of the pay-fors to anything to do with transportation. I think there are potentially opportunities when you think about energy space to think about nexuses, to think about things that could be good for the industry, that could be good long-term for economic growth, that ought to be part of the debate. So I would echo what Lisa says. Anybody that tries to pick a piece of this bill early on and say, let me find a way to be against it, I don't think that makes good sense. I do think we're going to need, not only from the White House standpoint, but I'm saying to my friends in industry, keep an open mind on things, because if we don't take advantage of this opportunity, it could be literally years before we come around again.
Let me ask you both a foreign policy question. In the report, you all talk about the connection between energy and nearly every foreign policy challenge we face around the world. Asia diversifying supply, natural gas for Europe, snapback sanctions on Iran. Are you hearing, as senators, are you all hearing from leaders in Europe and in Asia and in other places about the importance of access to U.S. energy?
Well, I will relay a conversation that I had when Prime Minister Abe was here visiting the White House several months ago. I think it was like April or so. And while I didn't speak directly with Prime Minister Abe, I did speak with many within his cabinet who were asking a very direct question. And they're saying, we receive oil from Iran. We would really rather not receive our oil from Iran. We would rather be able to receive oil from the United States. What are you doing about it, United States? And it was a good discussion to have because I reminded them that this is not something that actually requires legislation. The Secretary of Commerce could actually make that decision working with the administration to allow for a waiver of the ban if it's a determination that it is in the best interest. So it is an avenue that the administration can pursue without full-on repeal of the export ban. So I've been pushing and urging other countries. Look at Poland. Poland is, I think it's 95 or 96% dependent on Russia for their oil. We work with Poland on a lot of other things, national missile defense. They're there with us again in the war against terror on everything. And yet, they've got to go to Russia for their oil. Don't you think that they would like a little bit of help from their friends in the United States? So yes, I've been hearing from folks.
Senator Roy?
You know, Dave, I have as well. I'm chair of the U.S.-India Caucus and went with the president and visited Prime Minister Modi. And they've got Prime Minister Modi's got a hugely ambitious project about moving India forward, but a lot of that is going to depend on its ability to build up its energy. And we see a country of over a billion people with rolling brownouts and blackouts through the hot season. I think there's enormous opportunities. Both, you know, India has done a lot promoting its use of renewables, particularly solar. Yet still, India is one of the largest users of traditional carbon fuels, coal. One of the things we've been talking about is, you know, it's our opportunity, even with you know, the president's proposed carbon rules, we'd still have about 31% here of our baseload being generated by coal. If we're going to be using coal in India or in the United States, we've got to find ways to use it cleaner in terms of energy mix. So this collaboration, both in terms of supply and joint use and joint development of technology, I think is a tremendously important asset. And what I'm hearing from not just the Indians, but they in particular, this is top on their agenda.
Great. One more quick one before we turn it over to the audience, and that's energy diplomacy. When I did energy diplomacy, I think I had a team of five. My successor, twice removed, Amos Hochstein, has a bureau, but still hasn't yet been confirmed as an assistant secretary. How important is energy diplomacy, you think, to accomplishing these objectives and leveraging the boom? How much do you think we can get Senate support for strengthening that bureau and its mission?
Well, I'm not so sure about strengthening the bureau necessarily. I've got great respect for the work that Mr. Hochstein is doing, and know that if they have support, they can likely do more. But just from the overall perspective of energy diplomacy. Look at all the hotspots around the world. Look at the volatility everywhere, it seems. And what are we doing from a military perspective? We're reducing our force strength. We sit at the pivot point in the Pacific in Alaska, and an army has just taken or proposed to take our one Arctic airborne unit and disassemble it, and it's due to budget cuts. And so we recognize that we will never have enough boots on the ground in all of the places around the world that perhaps might merit some attention. So what other tools do we have? And it's that proverbial diplomatic toolkit that we have, and the energy piece needs to be a significant tool in that toolkit.
Let me just add that one. Amos has been a friend of mine for more than a decade plus, and I think he's doing a great job with very limited resources, and I think he needs to get confirmed. And I would agree with Lisa, though, that this is one more tool in the toolkit, and because we have constraints on our energy supply and usage, we're not able to use this tool as effectively as we should. Now, let's again recognize, I think it is important to put a caveat here as well, that maybe some in the industry would have predicted, but as a relatively keen outside observer, I'm not sure anyone could have predicted a decade ago that we would have access to as much ample resources as we do right now. So this really has been a game shifter. Again, commend Senator Murkowski, having now finally starting to move federal policy to catch up with access to these resources is a terribly important move, and we've got to use it as part of one of our strategic tools. I would simply add that, again, as we think about how we get from here to there on legislation, one of the things, I don't want to presume here, but having been involved in lots of finance and budget-related conversations with Lisa, you know, I think we would both concur that one of the stupidest, worst things that we could do in terms of economic recovery, in terms of our military presence around the world, is allow the stupidity of sequestration to come back on. starting in 60 plus days. And as, again, we think more creatively about how to avoid that, there's some of the items that are involved in the energy portfolio might be involved in a larger solution about how you get rid of sequestration as well.
Terrific. Let's take some questions from the audience, and then the first question, the gentleman in the back had his hand up first.
Good morning, and I'm Maciej Pisarski. I'm Poland's chargé d'affaires. I'll be brief, but I cannot help thanking Ambassador Morningstar and the Atlantic Council for gathering us to discuss this important topic. Senator Murkowski, Senator Warner, thank you very much for your leadership on that issue. And I could not agree more with Senator Murkowski about the importance and geopolitical utility of having the access for countries like Poland to American energy resources, oil or energy. We are fully in agreement, and thank you very much for your leadership in this. My question is about United States and European Union discussing TTIP agreement about partnership on investment and trade. I would like to ask you, senators, about how do you see energy playing a role in this strategic discussion between United States and European Union about creating this sphere of free trade and investment partnership? What role energy should play in it? Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I would just. The truth is, we've just, for me at least, we have just gotten through the very heated debate on trade promotion authority. I've supported, unlike many in my party, the idea that we ought to go ahead and expand trade. I think that is both a economic necessity. I think it is good for America. It is good for the world. You've got to have guide rules on that at that trade process. And clearly, the immediate focus is more the TTP. And in terms of, I know Ambassador Froman is out, I believe, doing heavy duty right now in Maui this week, trying to conclude those conversations. But back again to some of the questions about the implications of this report, if we can reshape American energy policy as we move to the discussions with our European partners in terms of what do those trade arrangements look like, if America's got more flexibility around use and distribution of its energy resources, that will clearly elevate the position of energy in those discussions.
Well, I would concur with what Senator Warner has said and just remind that if we are going to limit ourselves with our own self-imposed ban on oil export, our ability to talk about what that free trade agreement might be in the energy sector is limiting. We can't do it if we have tied our hands. Just to kind of segue from that just a little, I have stated quite clearly, I think, and rather loudly at times, that the effort that will move forward if this Iran negotiation proceeds and the sanctions on Iranian oil are lifted, while we keep in place our own ban on exporting U.S. oil, we are effectively sanctioning U.S. oil producers. We let Iran go out and enjoy the benefits of a global marketplace out there and gain full advantage to their treasury while we sanction our own U.S. oil producers.
So let's thank Senator Murkowski. Senator Warner, do you have time for a couple more questions? Let's thank Senator Murkowski.
I'm going to let Mark field them all. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you so much. Make sure you get out. That's great. Great. Next, we'll go to Bronco Terzic in the second row here.
Senator, I'm Bronco Terzic with the Council here in Berkeley Research. A political question. The price of gasoline at the pump is low today. Does that benefit the argument for the public in front of the consumer that we ought to lift the export ban, or does that hurt it?
I think that I've heard people argue against the export ban in saying that lifting the export ban might raise the price of gasoline. The reality is, in economic studies we've seen from Brookings to AEI and all folks in between, is that lifting the ban on export of oil could potentially lower the price of gas from, I think most folks are in that 6 to 8 cents range. I've seen 2 to 12 cent range. I think there needs to be a little more, doing a better job of getting those studies out, number one. Number two, and this is, I'm saying that there may be opportunities here, to get an export ban lifted. You're going to have to make some kind of more comprehensive approach, some kind of trade, some kind of idea of, you know, whether it's tied back to infrastructure or whether it's dealing with sequestration. There's an opportunity, I believe, if particularly the industry doesn't reflexively react, to get to yes in a way that gives certainty, gives predictability, as opposed to saying, well, we're going to wait maybe for 3 years and hope for different national election results to give us an opportunity. I think prudent, smart, thoughtful investors will be open to those kind of conversations. Ironically, while it may be easier for to sell the case to the public at this point, with the industry having challenges at, you know, $48, $49 a barrel, it may be harder for the industry to kind of see the long-term value of making a trade, but this is going to be a long-term game and a long-term process, and I think if we miss this window, people will look back a few years from now, we won't have the kind of job creation, we won't have the 20 to 25% increase in production, we won't have the ability to use this tool in a more, to advance American interests around the world, but there's going to have to require some kind of a trade here.
Time for one more. Nelson Cunningham.
Hi, Senator. Nelson Cunningham, McClarty Associates. As a board member of the Atlantic Council, thank you for doing this, and thank you for your comments about the expanded reach of the Council. My question is slightly off topic, but I spent 2 years as chair of the Ex-Im Bank Advisory Committee. We've all seen in the last week the Senate did its job, and the House hasn't. This is an issue I think that a lot of people in the room follow. What's your prognosis for the Ex-Im Bank and how that might move forward?
You know, Nelson, I thought you were my friend. You know, I have about as much clarity about what the process forward for the Ex-Im Bank is as being able to predict what's going to happen in the Republican debate next week. So I find it stunning. Absolutely stunning that the overwhelming majority of the Congress, I think Republican and Democrat voted, which I supported, by the way, and took arrows for, supported, let's go ahead and expand America's global reach, expand our opportunities for trade. And then a whole lot of those same folks who said, we want to expand trade, say, we don't want to have the ability to have in the toolkit the ability to finance American companies to do business abroad. I find a complete total disconnect in how this became an issue of almost kind of ideological fundamentalism is a mistake. And one of the things that I find, as someone who generally sides, been criticized many times within the Democratic Party for being a pro-growth, pro-business Democrat, and I'll take those arrows. I do get concerned at times when so many colleagues from in the business community say, well, on Ex-Im, we're really gonna hold people's feet to the fire. And while we have seen certain entities do that, overall, I just could imagine if this had been the Democrats stopping Ex-Im, what might be happening in town. We did get a strong vote. I think we ended up with 66, 67 votes. You know, I think Senator Cornyn and others said, you know, when two-thirds of the Senate want something, even if the leadership doesn't want it, it's going to happen. I think a open vote in the House would give us the same kind of majorities, but it is opaque, to say the least, at this point. I think it's unfortunate that Ex-Im has become a pawn in kind of the legislative back and forth. Let the House vote, and you know, let's take the let the House work its will, but let the House work its will, because it's going to be a bipartisan consensus. And again, as you know, as we look at our competitive nations, you know, Canada, much smaller GDP, but much larger per capita export support facility, Brazil, France, and you know, we need not even talk about what the Chinese do in terms of their support. So it is, I think, enormous business mistake for us not to reauthorize EXIM and do it quickly and soon.
Great, thank you. Senator, you have time for one more?
You know, I should get out on the EXIM question, because that was like, if I couldn't hit that softball, I'll take one more, and then it's always the last question that kills you. So
All right, we're going to move to the gentleman there in the red shirt on the aisle, and then that'll be our last question.
Hi, my name is Lee Stewart. I work with the group Beyond Extreme Energy. So it seems you've judged the science around climate change and determined the consensus to keep fossil fuels in the ground now is trumped by short-term gain and the interest of an economic elite. But what of the people when free of the industry money so-called government agencies like FERC are dependent on, determine that fracking hurts their communities and human civilizations because of the increasingly clear and catastrophic effects of climate change? What recourse do we have as people when our senators don't recognize the reality that fossil fuel extraction must happen now and regulatory agencies act as rubber stamps, as is happening all over the country, including in Augusta and Nelson counties in our state, Senator, and in Lusby, Maryland, where by and large the community where Dominion is building Cove Point export facility do not want an export monster in their backyard?
Thank you for the question, for proving Senator Warner correct.
Fair questions. Fair questions. I appreciate the turn of the question. On you know, the proposed pipelines in Virginia, you know, they've not even filed yet, so let's wait till they file. They constantly are even changing their routes, and I think one of the things we've been consistently urging FERC to do, and I think sometimes to their chagrin, is making sure both sides get a fair hearing. Some of the earlier hearings seemed a little stacked one way, as opposed to where I think the community's got to have its voice heard, number one. Number two, where I would, I absolutely believe the threat and challenge of climate change is real and current. We have places, again, being Virginia-centric in Norfolk, Virginia, where a church has to change its schedule almost a weekly basis because of almost weekly flooding because of rising sea levels. This is happening not decades from now, it's happening now. And one of the comments I made in my opening comments was that I think the continued science and review, particularly vis-a-vis fracking, is something that's extraordinarily important. We can debate it right now, but I absolutely believe that we have to proceed and on any energy source. You know, when you put all your eggs in one basket, you make potentially a mistake. Number three, you know, as we look at, for example, export of LNG or American development of natural gas, we've actually seen uniquely America move faster and farther in terms of carbon emissions than most of our European friends who had much stricter regimes because of that development. And then finally, you know, and again, let me be very clear, I'm talking about there would have to be an interesting, to say the least, negotiation vis-a-vis export. But the world is using a certain amount of hydrofuels, hydrocarbons. I candidly believe that American hydrocarbons are both extracted in a cleaner, more efficient way, say, than Venezuelan, Russian, and I believe you're talking about here substitution, not increasing the carbon footprint. We could debate that, but and final point I just simply make is, and one of the things I think the report stressed as well, is that, a decade ago we couldn't think about the access to energy that we have in this country at this point. I do believe a decade from now as well, we're getting very quickly towards the tipping point on solar, wind, renewables, and others. I would actually put, just to not leave, you know, to further stir the pot a little bit, nuclear in that pile as well, because if we're talking about carbon, it is carbon-free. But you absolutely validated the question that the last question is always one to get you. So thank you, though, for your comments.
Great. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you for listening to the Atlantic Council Events Podcast. For more information, please visit our website at atlanticcouncil.org and follow us on Twitter at Atlantic Council. The Atlantic Council, working together to secure the future.